The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a really fascinating journey. We're heading across one-third of the entire planet's land surface, and our guide is the acclaimed geographer, Nick Middleton.
That's right. We're diving into his exploration of deserts, and this deep dive has one really crucial mission.
But
completely break down that popular stereotype of deserts being, you know, just barren, useless wastelands.
And I think that's so important, because if I just say the word desert to you, what comes to mind?
Oh, for sure. It's hot, it's sand, there's nothing there.
Exactly. Endless sand dunes, punishing heat, and like a total absence of life. But that's the myth that we're here to bust.
Absolutely. The sources show us that this picture is almost completely wrong. Deserts are incredibly complex, they're dynamic, and they're deeply, deeply tied into our global future.
So they're not just these remote, empty places. They're actually key players in how the whole planet works. And if we don't get them right, we can't really tackle the big issues like climate change.
And our guide for this, Nick Middleton, he's the perfect person for the job.
Tell us a bit about him. What makes him so qualified?
Well, he's a physical geographer and an environmental scientist and a fellow at St. Anne's College at Oxford. He has spent decades, literally decades, teaching and researching arid lands and desertification.
So he's got the academic credentials for sure, but what makes his perspective so engaging, you know, for us?
It's the mix. He combines that rigorous, high-level research with real-world, on-the-ground experience.
So he's not just in an ivory tower.
Not at all. He's been out there all over the world in these places. He's felt the extremes. He's seen the ecosystems up close. And that kind of firsthand knowledge, it just changes everything.
And he's a great communicator too, right? I think I've seen some of his TV work.
Yeah, exactly. The series Going to Extremes. So he knows how to explain not just what deserts are, but more importantly, why they matter to all of us in a way that just clicks.
Okay, so let's get into the core argument of his work. What's the big idea?
The big idea is that deserts are unified by one single principle. And it's not what you think. It's not heat. It's not sand.
It's aridity.
It's aridity. The overwhelming absence of available water. That's the key that unlocks everything.
And these systems, these arid systems, cover a third of the Earth's land. So the book is kind of giving us the whole picture.
The whole picture. It pulls in geology, climatology, biology, anthropology. It connects all the dots.
Which you have to do, right? Because
yeah.
You can't understand the life in a desert without understanding the climate or the rocks.
And the human history, it all fits together. And he builds this journey for the readers so perfectly.
How so?
He starts with the basic definition, you know, the science. Then he moves to how the landscapes form. The incredible ways life adapts.
And the human element, like the Bedouin and Tuareg cultures.
Exactly. And then he brings it right up to the present day, showing why deserts are so critical now for resources and, well, for climate change solutions.
So the big takeaway is that we have to stop thinking of them as wastelands.
We have to. Understanding them is essential for dealing with some of the biggest challenges of the 21st century.
Okay, let's dig into that foundational argument then. Let's talk about the science of aridity. How do we define a desert?
Right. So the key concept here is something called the aridity index. It sounds technical, but the idea is actually pretty simple.
Break it down for us.
It's basically a ratio. It compares the amount of water coming in, so rain to the amount of water the atmosphere is trying to pull out.
And that second part is potential evapotranspiration.
Exactly. Think of it as the atmosphere's thirst or its drying power. In a desert, the atmosphere's thirst is way, way bigger than the supply of water from the sky.
And this is where our whole mental image gets an upgrade. Because applying that index leads to a really surprising conclusion.
It really does. It means the world's biggest and driest desert is Antarctica.
Wow. Which is just about the coldest place on Earth.
Right. It completely decouples desert from heat. Antarctica is a desert because all the water is locked up as ice. It's there, but it's not available. So the air is incredibly dry. Life can't get to the water.
That one fact just changes your entire framework for what a desert can be.
It does. A desert can be ice.
Okay, so they're not always hot. Let's tackle the next myth. They're not all sand either.
Not even close. Those classic sand seas you see in the movies, they're called ergs. And they only make up about 20% of the world's deserts.
Only 20%. So what's the other 80%?
The majority is actually covered by two other main types of surface. First, you have regs. These are huge plains of stone and gravel.
So like a rocky pavement.
That's a great way to put it. The wind has blown all the fine sand away, leaving this hard, crunchy surface. And then you have hamadas, which are these high, rocky plateaus, hard, barren rock.
And this leads to a really interesting paradox about water, doesn't it?
Oh, it's one of the most amazing parts. Even though water is so scarce, when it does rain, it's often in these incredibly intense, sudden bursts.
A flash flood.
Exactly. And because the ground is so hard and baked, it can't absorb the water. So for a few hours, these flash floods become the single most powerful force shaping the landscape.
Carving out canyons and those dry riverbeds, the wadis.
They carve everything. The very thing the desert lacks is also its most powerful sculptor. It's an incredible paradox.
Which makes it even more amazing that anything manages to live there at all. So let's talk about the ingenuity of life.
Yeah, the desert is like a living laboratory for evolution. And the life there isn't just, you know, barely clinging on. It has evolved these brilliant, incredibly efficient solutions.
It's all about the economy of water.
It's all about the economy of water. With plants, you see two main strategies. You have the spenders, the phreatophytes, like mesquite trees.
They send roots down incredibly deep.
Unbelievably deep to tap into groundwater that's way below the surface. Then you have the savers, or really the avoiders, the ephemerals.
Ah, these are my favorite. The patient plants.
They really are. Their seeds can lie dormant in the soil for years, sometimes for decades, just waiting.
Waiting for that one perfect rain.
Oh, when it comes, boom. They explode into life, they flower, they set seed, and they die in just a few weeks, finishing their entire life cycle before the water disappears again.
It's just incredible timing. And what about animals? The kangaroo rat always blows my mind.
The kangaroo rat is the ultimate example of efficiency. It's a marvel of physiology.
Because it never has to drink water. Not once in its life.
Never. It gets all the moisture it needs from its food, from the metabolic process of digesting dry seeds. It literally manufactures its own water.
Which brings us to a really critical distinction Middleton makes.
Mm-hmm.
We have to separate the idea of a natural desert from desertification.
Yes. This is maybe the most important policy point in the book. A desert is a natural biome. Desertification is a man-made disaster.
So desertification isn't just the desert getting bigger on its own?
Not at all. He describes it as the death of productive land by a thousand cuts. It's land that used to be productive, maybe for grazing or farming, that is being degraded by human mismanagement.
And what are those main drivers? What are the cuts?
The big ones are overgrazing, which strips the protective plant cover from the soil, deforestation for fuel, and crucially, really poor irrigation methods.
Which leads to salinization.
Yes, salinization. When you flood a field in a hot, dry place, the water evaporates fast, but it leaves behind all the salt that was dissolved in it.
And over time, the soil becomes so salty that nothing can grow.
It becomes toxic. And the Sahel region in Africa is sort of the tragic poster child for this, where climate pressures and human mismanagement combined into a catastrophe.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Middleton also focuses on the immense potential of deserts. He really wants to challenge that wasteland idea.
Absolutely. He points out they hold huge reserves of resources, you know, oil, gas, copper, diamonds. But the biggest resource isn't what's under the ground.
It's what's shining down from above.
It's the sun. Deserts are, without question, the best places on Earth for large-scale solar power. The clear skies, the intense radiation, they're basically the planet's future powerhouses.
So that reframes them from being a problem to being part of the solution?
A central part of the solution for the renewable energy transition.
Okay, that's a lot of detail. Let's pull back and synthesize the big themes. What are the key messages you think he wants us to walk away with?
I'd say theme number one is just deconstructing this stereotype. The big lesson is that aridity, the water budget, is what matters, not heat. And that gives you this unified vision that can include both the Sahara and Antarctica.
Right. It forces you to think like a scientist, not just based on, you know, what you've seen in movies.
Exactly. Then theme number two would be adaptation and resilience. The book is just a celebration of ingenuity.
It's not about suffering. It's about brilliant solutions.
Brilliant, efficient solutions. And that's inspiring. You know, it shows how you can thrive under extreme constraints, which is a lesson we can all use.
For sure. And the third theme.
The third is the human footprint. It's about that contrast between coexistence and degradation.
The traditional cultures versus modern pressures.
Right. Cultures like the Bedouin had this deep symbiotic relationship with the desert, this traditional ecological knowledge. Modern pressures can just shatter that delicate balance and lead to desertification. So it's a choice about how we want to live in these environments.
The book is also just full of these powerful, memorable ideas. Let's share a few that really capture that paradigm shift he's advocating for.
Yeah, there are a few lines that just stick with you.
Okay, here's the first one on the definition. A desert is defined not by the presence of sand or heat, but by the overwhelming absence of water.
That's the whole thesis right there. It recalibrates everything.
Exactly. Here's the second, on desertification. Desertification is not the march of the desert's sandy frontier. It is the death of productive land by a thousand cuts inflicted by human hands.
So powerful. It removes any ambiguity. It makes it clear that this is a crisis of management, not a natural process. We are responsible.
And finally, on the future. Once viewed as wastelands to be crossed or conquered, deserts are emerging as the resource powerhouses of the future. They're most abundant. Resource is not buried beneath the sand, but shines down from above, the sun.
And that just captures the whole shift in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
From liability to asset, from empty space to a source of global solutions.
So how do we apply all this in the real world? For starters, there's a huge implication for environmental policy.
A massive one. Understanding that desertification is human-caused means the solutions have to be human-focused. It's not about trying to stop the desert. It's about sustainable farming, managing grazing, and using smart irrigation.
It changes where you put the money and the effort.
Completely. And then there's the inspiration for innovation and biomimicry.
You look at something like the kangaroo rat.
And you think, how can we copy that? How can we develop crops that are more drought-resistant? How can we create water purification tech that's as efficient as a desert animal's kidneys? Nature has already solved these problems.
And I think on a personal level, it just encourages you to be a more critical thinker.
Yeah, to challenge your own preconceptions. The next time you see a desert in a movie portrayed as this empty, hostile void, you can say, hang on, there's a whole lot more going on there. You appreciate the hidden richness.
So what's your final takeaway from this deep dive? What's the biggest lesson for you?
For me, it's that our perception of a place completely shapes how we treat it. As long as we see deserts as wastelands, we'll neglect or exploit them. But once we see them as these valuable, fragile, essential ecosystems, we start to think about stewardship. It all starts with changing our minds.
I think for me, it's just that raw, unbelievable ingenuity of life. The kangaroo rat, the ephemeral plants. It's just this profound reminder of the tenacity of life and that efficiency is a kind of superpower.
It really is. And that's the thought I think we should leave everyone with. If we can learn the economy of water that's practiced by every living thing in the desert, what other efficiencies with our time, our energy, our resources could we unlock in our own lives?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.